Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. First, I want to send a thank you to all the supporters of the Drug Truth Network at the Mothership Station during our recent pledge drive. You guys came through again. Today, we have with us another member, another speaker for law enforcement against prohibition. He had a piece published just last week in the U.S. News and World Report. The title, Drugs Are Too Dangerous Not to Regulate, We Should Legalize Them. He's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's author of the book, Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. And with that introduction, let's welcome our guest, Professor Peter Moskos. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well, sir. Glad to have you with us. I found it invigorating to see your article in the U.S. News and World Report, a very established and mainstream publication, giving the leap position. Tell us about that article, please, sir.
Well, first, I'm just happy that such an article gets the press in a mainstream magazine like U.S. News. I mean, Leap's position and my position, Leap, it's law enforcement officials, prosecutors, people involved actively in the criminal justice system who support legalizing drugs. And that, just saying that even, is almost a taboo subject for a lot of people. But the way I like to put it is, look, I don't want a free-for-all, which is what we have now, is I want to regulate drugs because they're dangerous. I don't think they're good. I just think that the problems of the war on drugs are far worse than anything we get from the drugs themselves.
Well, this is so true on any front, any measure by which you examine the policy and its impact, its ramifications, blowback, etc. There just doesn't seem to be any logical reason for it to continue, right?
Exactly, which then, you know, makes me wonder, why does it continue? And I like to think that talking about the issue and educating people, because there's so much propaganda put out there by prohibitionists to continue the war on drugs, that we just have to counter that, because once you talk to people, it's pretty easy to convince them that what we're doing now simply isn't working.
Well, just this morning I saw a piece coming out of the British newspapers talking about that cannabis use had gone down, cocaine use had gone up during the last couple of years, and I think the use of cannabis was 10%, the use of cocaine was 2%, and then they said, but it's good that the findings for the children show a lesser usage rate, but they showed once again 10% cannabis, 2% cocaine. It just seems there are a certain few people who have a proclivity to use certain of these drugs. Your thoughts on that, sir?
We're always going to have people who take drugs because people want to get high, and a lot of people can take drugs without great problems, especially something like marijuana. I think the important thing when you look at countries that have liberalized drug policies, and of course the Netherlands always comes to mind, where anybody, any adult can walk into a legal store and legally buy and smoke marijuana or hash. In a country like the Netherlands, the usage rates are lower than America. I mean, by any standard, as you said, by any standard, what we're doing doesn't work. We have more users, we spend more money, we have more crime, and it's all because we try to ban a substance, and prohibition just doesn't work.
Well, this is true, and then, you know, I mean, we have the problems of use and the attendant crime to pay the high black market prices, leading to, I don't know how to say it, a free-for-all by most police departments to circumvent the Constitution, do illegal searches, test a lie in court, and do anything to keep those drug crime rates high. Meantime, the investigation and solution of more violent crimes, including rape and murder, is going down. Well, once again, we're just missing the boat, aren't we?
Yeah, and I can say, I mean, as a former Baltimore police officer, I fought the war on drugs, and I wasn't testifying, and I wasn't violating the Constitution. I was locking up drug dealers. I know it doesn't work. I mean, yeah, it works in the sense we put more people in prison, if that's the goal, and you know, maybe for some people that is. But the drug corners are just as bad now after I was a police officer as they were before I went in there. And to me, the big problem with drug dealing is the public drug dealer. If we could just all buy drugs peaceably from people we know, that's how most people buy marijuana. That's not a big problem. It's the guys on the corner who are slinging, and they're the ones who are shooting each other, and you get the sort of thug culture based out of the drug trade. And this is what regulation could just eliminate.
Right. And then we have, over the last 5, 6, 7 years in particular, seen the rise of the Taliban, the resurrection of the Taliban, if you will. And it has happened because they, in essence, have been allowed to grow flowers on the mountainside, and these flowers can then be turned into cash and then into weapons with which to kill our soldiers and the NATO soldiers. Your thoughts on that, sir?
It's shameful, really, because the only reason that terrorists make money off drugs is because they're illegal. Look, the average poor farmer in Afghanistan, he doesn't want to necessarily sell to criminals. He doesn't care who he sells to. He's got to feed his family. And if the government had a market where they could sell these products that are getting grown anyway, clear. I mean, that would be better for everyone. And then the money could go to governments who are trying to fight terrorists. I mean, and the real shame, of course, is that our government now tries to link the war on terrorism with the war on drugs. But it's the war on drugs that creates terrorists. And, I mean, Afghanistan's producing more drugs now than after we've invaded them. I mean, if we invade countries and we can't win the war on drugs, I mean, what hope does that give us? I mean, we know there is no hope. We're not going to win this. We've been doing it for almost 100 years. I mean, we got to try something else.
Exactly. My friends, we're talking to Professor Peter Moskos. He's had an article published recently in the U.S. News and World Report talking about drugs are too dangerous not to regulate. And he's also author of the book, Cop in the Hood. Peter, I want to ask you, as a one of my band of brothers, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition group, you know, we do have to, I don't think we're sticking our necks out, but it is perceived by many that we're going over the line, especially when the politicians and the press just never delve into the reasons behind the horrors of this drug war. But I'm finding that more and more people are accepting of that need to at least investigate the need for change. Am I right?
Yeah, and I hope if I keep talking about these issues that we get some of the politicians to discuss it, because still, right now, with the exception of maybe someone like Ron Paul, all the politicians pretty much walk in lockstep again. I mean, supporting the war on drugs. They're not votes to be gained yet and saying let's regulate drugs, because it's still considered a crazy position. But, I mean, we regulate alcohol, we regulate cigarettes. And, you know, it's not perfect, but by and large it's more successful. I mean, we tried prohibition against alcohol, and that was a horrible failure. And you just wish people would learn from these mistakes a little bit. But, I mean, I think the trends are in the right direction. Certainly, I mean, California now has, you know, with medicinal marijuana, I mean, that is a gateway to drug regulation, and I say great. I mean, because we can at least let the states try it. I'm not saying also that, you know, that suddenly dealing heroin in your neighborhood is going to be legal, but why not leave it up to the cities and states, and then we can see what works and what doesn't. You know, that's the way we get good policy decisions, but the war on drugs isn't about policy. It's about prohibition.
Exactly. Now, you know, it's my understanding that the President of the United States could, with a stroke of his pen, basically end the drug war, at least the drug war on the American people, by moving these so-called controlled substances from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 or 3, and then the DEA would have a real job to stop the traffickers, to stop the multi-ton shipments, rather than the ongoing war against the American people. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and let's also not forget all the people who die from drug overdoses. I mean, in general, people don't care much about junkies, but these are real human beings who are dying, and the number is huge, too, of people in America dying from overdoses. I think of something like 30,000 in the last year, people counted. I mean, that's a lot of deaths, and this is also no. addicts don't want to die. They want to get high. And the only reason they're dying is because they're buying illegal substances. They don't know what they're taking. And they, you know, they make mistakes. But if we could regulate usage like we regulate pharmaceuticals, other pharmaceuticals, overdose deaths would really drop to almost zero, because there's no reason anybody should overdose from drugs.
Well, and most people don't ever delve into the reason behind most of these overdose deaths. I see it as two points. I think you touched on it, the fact that they get a hot shot. They're used to buying some 10%, 20% solution, and suddenly a batch comes through.
40%.
And they just take their usual dose, and it kills them. And then the secondary thing is that under this policy of prohibition, if you're in a room with a friend and he looks like he's ODing, you got two choices. Call the police and risk a jail sentence for one or both of you in that room, or leave the room and hope he recovers.
Yeah, and there have been some interesting programs in cities, including Baltimore, and I talk about this a bit in my book, Cop in the Hood, where they're giving addicts Narcan, which is this sort of an amazing drug that prevents overdoses, and it saves lives, without doubt. In every city it's been tried. People live because of it, and yet prohibitionists are against it because they're not trying to save lives, and that's the unconscionable part I find about the war on drugs. I mean, we can debate, you know, issues about distribution and usage rates. I mean, those are important things, but the goal should be to save lives, and if you can do that best by regulating drugs, I mean, how can you really be against that?
Well, my phrase I use for that scenario you're talking about there is drug users are unconditionally exterminable, and that's kind of how they're treated.
Yeah, and you see that from the politicians, and also, I mean, from police officers, unfortunately, because, I mean, there's police who are on the streets dealing with drug problems day after day, and understandably, you know, they get frustrated, and they see the addicts as the source of the problem, but it doesn't have to be that way.
No, not at all. Just yesterday, we had another cop arrested here in my hometown, accused of stealing from drug sellers, you know.
And the temptation is there. I mean, as a police officer, you are dealing with constantly, if you're working in a drug area like I did, you're just constantly got cash and drugs from drug dealers. And I mean, the good news is, by and large, and I you know, if people who think all cops are corrupt, I can't convince them, but all I can do is say that it's not part of the culture, and cops don't want to risk their pension. It's just not worth it for $50 here, $100 there. The pension's pretty good. It's the police officers' credit that they're so professional that they are able to stay clean through all this. But every single time you get a story about corruption in the police departments, any kind of scandal, there is always a drug link. It always comes back to drugs. And it would be great if we could just remove that from the whole law enforcement equation. You know, let doctors deal with health problems. I mean, you know, we don't arrest people yet for smoking cigarettes. And that's the one drug that we managed to reduce the usage of.
Well, yes, and contained within that piece in the U.S. News and World Report, you talked about, you know, that we were able to reduce the use of tobacco without having to send people to prison. And it's just logic, common sense, and a true education that will help, right?
Yeah, and it's education, it's taxes. I mean, the money that this could bring into the government when we need the money. Just all you got to do is regulate it. I mean, and I use the word legalization because you can't regulate something that's illegal. And that's where the whole system kind of breaks down. We would have more control over drugs if we legalized them. And it's, you know, it's a little counterintuitive, but I mean, you can look at example after example and you go, oh yeah, of course you need regulation to control something.
Well, once again, we're speaking with Mr. Peter Moskos, who has written a book, Cop in the Hood, had a piece in the U.S. News and World Report here recently. And Peter, I speak to a lot of Lions clubs, you know, seniors. We get together and I give about a 20-minute presentation. And I'm finding almost unanimous support of the need for change. Now, there is still this fear that, oh my gosh, more people will use, or somehow children will have better access. And I try to allay those fears, but people just have this general paranoia that what we have is better than a change. Your thoughts on that?
I think you got your finger on the pulse there. It's this idea that we barely have things under control now, and any change, and suddenly things spiral out of control. But I think, I mean, you just got to use logic, and there are places where this has been tried, and you know, the world hasn't ended. Be it the Netherlands or California with medicinal marijuana. None of these systems are perfect, but that doesn't matter. They're better, and, you know, you can keep changing them. Some things work, some don't. There are better ways to do it. And that's where I do think, as you know, if the ball gets rolling, momentum's going to gain, and once people see, okay, it's not so bad. I mean, one thing I like doing when I speak to groups is say, look, if heroin was legal tomorrow, how many of you would shoot up? And nobody raises their hand. I mean, maybe they don't admit it, but there are lots of people do or don't take drugs, and it seems like the law is pretty low down on the list.
Right, right. And again, I asked that question, and of course no one did raise their hand. But it's just that paranoia, that thought that it could get worse. It's so bad now. But they do agree we need to talk to the politicians and the newspaper editors.
When you look at the neighborhoods in this country that are worst damaged by the war on drugs, you know, in all honesty, it couldn't get much worse. I mean, the level of violence and death and blight and despair, it makes a lot of third world shanty towns look better. I mean, this and part of the problem too is people say, well, the problem's over there, at least it's not in my neighborhood yet. But the problem doesn't have to be anywhere. And I mean, and don't we care about the people in neighborhoods that are getting killed and they're overdosing? And to some extent, unfortunately, answer, maybe we don't, but you know, we certainly should.
Yes, yes, and you know, I do feel a change is afoot. That people are becoming more and more aware of the need for that change. They just they're still just leery. Once again, we're speaking with Mr. Professor Peter Moskos. You teach at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Is that right?
That's correct, in New York City. Yeah.
Tell us about the new students. What are their perceptions of this drug war?
You know, it's interesting because at the undergraduate level, I'd say the majority of my students, it's a four-year liberal arts college, but if you go to a school of criminal justice, you got some interest in the field, and a lot want to become police officers, because in New York you have to have at least 2 years of college to get hired. And, I mean, I like to think that at some point I'm making an impact, and it's not that I'm telling police officers not to enforce the law, but the job is to enforce the law, but you don't have to, one, make it a crusade. I mean, I did lock up drug dealers, but I wasn't out there violating people's rights to do it. And if you put it in perspective, and I got to say, at the end of my class, you know, a lot more of my students, and these are future police officers and some current police officers, have a bit more perspective on the war on drugs. I mean, partly, you know, if we could just move the clock back 30 years. I mean, drugs have been illegal for longer than that, but we didn't get infatuated with them until the 70s. If we could just move the clock back, we could reduce a lot of the harms. Public drug use and drug dealing should be seen as a quality of life issue, and that's why I didn't have a problem as a police officer locking up drug dealers, because they were obnoxious. You know, and I thought, if I worked in this neighborhood, what would I want me to do? But if you see it for what it is, which is a health problem, when it's in public, a quality of life problem, then you can start focusing on these policy levels. But as long as you talk about morality or drugs are evil, that just gets the debate off on a wrong step.
I think we have just about a minute or two left, and I want to give you the chance to give a pep talk, if you will, to those other current and former law enforcement justice officials. We're a group now of more than 10,000 members and supporters. We have some 100-plus speakers who go to the Lions Clubs and the Elks Clubs and the colleges and so forth to talk about the fundamentals of law enforcement against prohibition. But
I urge police officers listening and judges and lawyers who deal with the war on drugs to not, and you don't want to risk your career. It still is dangerous. You know, it's going to be hard to rise in the ranks of a police department if you're a loud advocate for drug legalization. But still, you can join LEAP. You can, and also people who aren't in it can become a friend of LEAP, and I urge them to do that too. So this is law enforcement against prohibition. But the bigger our numbers are, and LEAP is a useful organization because it gets away from the sort of long-haired hippie stoner stereotype of people who want to legalize drugs. You know, we're not drug users, and that's the important thing. Is we're saying, look, it doesn't matter. It's not about people who want to get high. It's about we as taxpayers and what we want in our public policy. So, I mean, the pep talk I give is, yeah, let your voice be heard. Think about this issue, and don't be afraid to speak out, because nothing will change until we do.
Well, you know, I guess it's been 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk up in Conroe, Texas. And after it was over, one of the attendees, I won't give his name or designation, but high up in the local police department, spent about 20, 30 minutes with me out in the parking lot talking about he agreed with 99% of what I had to say. So even in a remote, a rural area like that,
Well, I think because police, I mean, they're naturally sympathetic because police, better than anybody, know that we're not about to win the war on drugs. So when you give them an alternative, which by and large they haven't heard, and say, look, we know these problems that are happening in your area. Here's, you know, think about what the source of those problems is. And that's why police are naturally sympathetic, because deep down they know that the war on drugs is failing.
Yeah. Indeed it is. Well, Peter, we're going to have to let it go for now. I'm going to invite you back at a future date. I very much appreciate the discussion.
Hey, I'm always here for you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Ventricular fibrillation and vasoconstriction, inhibition of the Pays pump, increased concentration of calcium in sarcoplasm of the cardiac cell, a positive inotropic effect that is caused by digitalis. Time's up. The answer, MEO, DMT, Piedra, Lovestone, Jamaican Stone, or Chinese Rock. From Buffo olivarius, skin of the toad. The doctors say the safest and surest way is not to eat it or lick it, and sure as hell not to smoke it, but simply to sniff it. Otherwise, you could wind up dead.
Did you know you could lose your college financial aid if you get convicted of a minor drug offense? According to the federal government, 1/3 of all college students have used marijuana in the past year. Imagine the devastation to our nation's economy if all of these students got the punishment that some lawmakers think they deserve. Join Students for Sensible Drug Policy and fight back against the government's drug war attacks on our generation. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out if there's a chapter at your school or how to start one.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
U.S. President Reagan famously identified the Afghan holy warriors, the Mujahideen, as freedom fighters while they were battling Russian occupation in the 1980s. Now, Reagan's freedom fighters have killed 500-plus American occupiers using similar tactics. New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall describes the aftermath of a recent attack which killed three U.S. National Guardsmen. Quoting from the Times, Afghan Army Captain Rahim did not see the bodies, but learned from an American officer that one or more had been butchered. Their bodies had no heads, legs, or arms. A Western official in Kabul confirmed that at least one of the bodies had been cut up. Organs were removed. End quote. Canada's Globe and Mail reports that the Afghan resistance earned nearly $1 billion last year from the sale of heroin and cannabis. Afghan heroin production has increased exponentially each year. The longer we stay, the more heroin the country produces. Last year, Afghanistan produced nearly 2 million pounds of pure heroin, far more than the world consumes annually. America and her allies have effectively done nothing to contain the illegal harvest. This historic heroin glut has resulted in far greater availability, dramatically lower prices, and escalating purity internationally. On New York's Long Island, where heroin use is reportedly skyrocketing among high school-aged youth, a packet of heroin now costs less than a packet of cigarettes. Australian, Scottish, and American law enforcement all report that heroin use and overdose are surging. Barely noticed by major media, in April 2008, the U.S. oil giant Unocal and Afghanistan finalized plans for a major pipeline running through Afghanistan's poppy belt. Construction is theoretically set to begin in 2010. Finally, Colombia is now considering sending troops to Afghanistan. Colombia currently has anti-narcotics advisors in the country, and former U.S. Ambassador to Colombia, William Wood, currently serves as chief U.S. diplomat to Afghanistan. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Terry Nelson spent 33 years working for the federal government, busting heads and billion-dollar cartels. He now does a weekly report for the Drug Truth Network and law enforcement against prohibition.
This is Terry Nelson speaking on behalf of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Today, I want to share with you some interesting information. For anyone that uses mind-altering substances, there are many in America who think we should cut off their hand or kill them or jail them and throw away the key. I have presented at civic clubs where people have said, we should do what Iran does, execute them for using drugs. And since I mentioned Iran, I now share with you what is currently happening in Iran, and I'm not talking about nuclear reactors. An article in the New York Times reports that Iran's government, trying to curb addiction's huge social cost, has been more supportive of drug treatment than any other government in the Islamic world, according to the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. It was not always this way. After the 1979 revolution, the government tried a more traditional approach, arresting drug users and putting them in jail. But two decades later, they recognized that this approach had failed. A sharp increase in the crime rate and the number of people infected with HIV, both directly linked to the surge in narcotics use, persuaded the government to shift strategies. We have realized that an addict is a social reality, said Mohammad Reza Hani, the vice president of the Committee on Combating Drugs, which coordinates the government's efforts to fight addiction and trafficking. We don't want to fight addicts. We want to fight addiction. We need to manage addiction. Iran has a population of approximately 65 million people and an official estimate of 1.1 million addicts, or approximately 1.6%. That is pretty much the world average and is close to the estimated average of 1.3% in the U.S. prior to the Harrison Drug Act in 1914, and again just before the war on drugs began in earnest in 1982. So it appears that no matter how severe the penalty, there will always be those that are addicted, and therefore the best approach to this problem is similar to what the Iranians have done, and that is to treat drug addiction as a sickness instead of a crime. LEAP recommends that the billions of dollars in savings from the justice system and proceeds from the taxes collected from legal drugs be used to provide medical treatment and pay for research into finding a cure for drug addiction. LEAP believes that drugs are too dangerous to be left in the hands of criminals. It's time to regulate and control them. Let's put the money into research, treatment, and education instead of jails and prisons. We all want a better future for ourselves and our children. This is Terry Nelson at www.leap.cc signing off.
Once again, that website, leap.cc. That's for any of you judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, whether you're working, retired, or whatever. If you'd like to get involved with this effort, please get in touch with us. We'd like to put you to work. We'd at least like to count you as a supporter of our group. I want to thank Peter Moskos, Professor Peter Moskos, works at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. My friends, the truth is out there. The truth is waiting for you to embrace it. It's waiting for you to speak it, to share it, to support it. And that's what it's really all about. We've all got to work together to make this change happen. Peter and I and Terry and all the good friends of LEAP cannot get this done by ourselves. We need your support. Be sure to join us on next week's Cultural Baggage. Our guest will be Wendy Chapkis. She's co-author of a brand new book, Dying to Get High, Marijuana as Medicine. You guys can get it done working together. If you want to get in touch with me, it's dean@drugtruth.net. I'd love to work with you guys. And as always, I remind you that because of Prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.